Greetings, travellers, and welcome to episode 85 of the Innsmouth Book Club podcast. As you can see, we've brought you straight to the Gillman House Hotel because we're going to be joined by an esteemed guest this evening. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Mendes.
And I'm the other one, Rob Poyton. Yes, and I have to say the old Gillman place is looking as dilapidated and run down as ever.
Yeah.
All part of the ambience, isn't it, here?
Yeah. I thought they were doing a refit, but it doesn't seem to have done anything to alter its charm, has it?
I think it's what they call a retro refit, isn't it? Was it distressed is the word, isn't it?
Distressed, yeah. What I used to call when I worked for a big brewery that shall remain nameless, a fur coat and no knickers refurb.
Yes, in this case, more of a sort of scowly coat.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's not go there. However, one place we will be going, we will be daring, is Innsmouth After Dark in September. I hear we've got a cracking lineup.
Indeed, yeah. Just put the finishing touches to the lineup. We're going to be headlined by UK gothic rock outfit Byronic Sex and Exile, who most of their stuff is based on classic gothic literature and weird tales. So they're kind of a perfect fit. It's also quite theatrical. He has a tendency to wave a sword around quite a lot.
I like him already.
Yeah, candelabras and all that kind of business. There's a lot of that going on. And Mr. CJ Hooper will be putting in another appearance doing his urban horror fairy tales because he went down a storm last time, so it'll be nice to give him a proper stage to do it on this time. And Matthew Wood from Edwardian Tales will be performing H.P. Lovecraft's The Outsider. And yes, and to top it all off, though, some idiot known as under the name DJ Mendes has put together a set of weird fiction inspired tunes to cap the night off with a disco, the Discotheque Necronomicon. So there you go. Yeah.
Oh, marvellous. And we're in a dedicated venue this time. We're at Esquire's in Bedford, which is the main music venue in Bedford. And of course, if you're attending the Innsmouth Literary Festival on the day, Innsmouth After Dark is included in your ticket price. But if you can't make the festival but want to come to the evening, you can buy a separate ticket just for the evening as well. All the details are up on the website, and we'll put the link to that in the show notes below, of course. So let's get on up the stairs and walk on down the hall and meet today's guest. And here he is. It's Mr. Thomas Campbell. Hey, Thomas, how are you doing?
Hi, yeah, not too bad, sir.
Yes, we're all good. So is this your first visit to Innsmouth?
Yes, it is, yes.
Well, I'm sure you know what to expect if you read Shadow over Innsmouth. So,
yeah. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I'm well prepared.
We got the lock off the trouser press yet?
Yeah.
So perhaps we could start by you introducing yourself, tell us where you're from, that kind of thing, and also how you first got into weird fiction and Lovecraft.
Yeah, sure. So my name's Thomas Campbell. I'm the writer of the Eldritch Survival Horror series, Abyssal Albion. I've also recently done a very not safe for work comic called Eldritch's Lust, as well as various other comic bits and pieces here. I've had a story that was in Cthulhu Invade Neverland, which was quite fun. So outside the comics, I also make a film, a screenwriter, which I mostly specialize within cosmic horror. I've co-founder, co-owner of Deadbolt Films, where we've done several cosmic horror shorts now. As for how I first got into weird fiction and Lovecraft, probably through my love of cinema and comics, to be honest. Always a massive, massive fan of the Alien series, which then led me, I'm sure this is a story common to many people, actually, led me down that sort of, you know, that unknown things lurking in space and where it all came from and H.R. Giger's artwork, and it kind of coalesced from there.
Right.
I was a big fan of like the Dark Horse comics growing up. I probably should not have been reading them at the age I was reading them. Yeah, so very much that side of things is how I got into it. And then obviously just exploring a bit further. I just realized that was completely my bag. I got really in, like, even on the gaming side of things, I was always drawn to like cosmic horror gaming and I just wanted to learn more about it, and made me pick up the books and read and read and read, go through all the ones you normally would do. Yeah.
So were you a sort of D&D player back in the day, and then got into Call of Cthulhu kind of thing?
No, I was never a D&D player. I always sat on the periphery. I watched like my older cousins and that play it, but I never really played it myself. But that said, over the past couple of years, I have actually been able to dabble a bit into the Call of Cthulhu itself.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was great. I'm sure there's footage of me playing it that was on YouTube as well.
Right.
Terrible. Terribly played it.
That's part of the fun, though, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I played, I think I just played like the FBI agent that was very, just what the hell is going on? Why is all this stuff happening? And then suggesting things that really an FBI agent shouldn't be doing, like digging up corpses and let's go raid the local cemetery and just waving my gun at everybody that was claiming I was mental. It went in very strange places. It was great.
I think it tends to. It's something we've spoken about before. It's one of the few games you play where you know you're going to lose in the end, whatever you do.
Yeah.
And also this sort of change from being the good guy, the law enforcement guy, to, like you say, the guy who's digging up corpses and threatening people.
Yeah.
My character's always quite just on the cusp of, like, what is going on? So, yeah. Quite like how I am in reality, to be honest.
So you mentioned Alien there as well, and Geiger, and of course Geiger had a art book out called The Necronomicon, didn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. So I've got to say, like, when I was at school, my art teacher had it, and I'd just spend my entire time in the art class, like, no matter what time, I should be in, like, French class or something like that, and I was like, no, I'm going up there, I'm just going to hide in there. I just spent hours poring over the artwork in that book, and I just loved it. Absolutely. Yeah, it's a fantastic book.
I can't think of many artists who have the same effect, apart from, like, Bosch, really. I mean, obviously, there's great artists doing a variety of things, but those two seem to be particularly out there in terms of being original.
I think the only other person I've ever felt kind of matches is it Baczynski. Yeah, Zawisław Baczynski. I cannot pronounce his first name, but yeah. No, definitely. His work is nightmare fuel for sure. Very much apocalyptic hellscapes, and it's bleak. It is bleak, absolutely. Totally worth looking into.
Oh, awesome. So was that kind of bleakness through that what inspired you into the Abyssal Albion? Because that's incredibly bleak. And obviously with the artists you've had working on that, I've kind of got that kind of bleakness to it.
Yeah, so the artist, Wayne Loudy, I love his work. He's very, when we first started doing it, he was very much just ink on paper, which is fantastic. It's kind of rare these days. A lot of people tend to use digital and all that sort of thing. But there was a very punk essence to his artwork, and it was kind of what I wanted for the story as well, just to get across that sort of, like, a very punk and bleak, that mixture into the art. But yeah, in regards to the actual story itself, yeah, always. I didn't want something that was overly happy. I didn't want something that... You have to have moments of levity within a story, don't you? I mean, let's face it, you can't be bleak all the time.
Unless you're Thomas Ligotti.
I was going to say, unless you're Thomas Ligotti.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's about the only one who can get away with it, I think. But...
I don't know. I think there's a slight bit of humour in the frolic.
There is.
There is quite a bit of satire. It's just hidden under layers and layers of depression.
Absolutely. I love it. I love his work.
He's an amazing writer, and it's one of those, I suppose, like any great artist, it just seems effortless, doesn't it? You know? It never feels contrived or anything like that.
Not at all. It is absolutely flawless.
And because Abyssal Albion, that's like a post-apocalyptic setting, right? So how did that come about? How did you develop the idea for that?
So Abyssal Albion first came about actually during COVID. Surprise, surprise. We couldn't make any films at the time, and I I love post-apocalyptic settings. I love, you know, the whole Mad Max. I love, like, 28 Days Later, Boy and His Dog. Anything that's post-apocalyptic, I just cling on to. I think, once again, it's the bleakness of it all. I just love it. I love that side of things. So I really wanted to do something that was apocalyptic. And then I thought, well, you know, with the love of cosmic horror, how about bring that into the apocalypse? Because essentially that's where that entire world would end up anyway. So it's like after the great old ones have like woken up and all that. But yeah, so during COVID, the world was all seeming kind of bleak and sad. I just felt like the world needed another story about the apocalypse at the time. So yeah, anyway, we couldn't make films. So I thought, well, this is a story that's been actually sat in my back pocket for a while now. And I've always wanted to have a go at writing comics. I've always loved comics, like I mentioned, like Dark Horse, Alien series, the Aliens vs. Predator. I liked Mignola's Hellboy. And on, like, you know, completely outside of that, I was a massive X-Men kid as well. Right. So the whole idea of doing comics has always appealed to me. And even when I stopped doing, like, reading superhero comics, I then went on to, like, the works of, like, Dan Clowes and all the more underground ones. So to be able to actually do that, I was like, right, I'm doing it. This is it. I've got nothing else to do. I'm sat at home. I can't work. Can't get into the office because the work I was doing at the time required me getting into the office. And, yeah, I wrote the first issue and then decided to go and try and find an artist that would be able to match the sort of the punk bleakness of the world that I wanted to build around. And yeah, went on Reddit, found an artist. And it, I don't know, it was really, I think it was just by luck, it all sort of came together. Like, that even the lettering, like, we're still using the same lettering now on the stuff we're using, because he's just perfect. Everything was just so perfect for the project.
Nice.
Don't know if that answers your question. That was just me rambling off then, but yeah.
Well, no, I think it's interesting sometimes things just come together like that. I mean, we've found that Tim and I have worked on a few projects together, and sometimes it all just clicks, and sometimes we have little rants with each other, don't we, about certain aspects of publishing.
I mean,
yeah, definitely.
I think, and strangely enough, even with the recent Eldritch Bluff, it just came together so quickly. Like, from the idea of, well, I think I made like a joke post on Twitter just saying, in one of these moods where I was like, no, nothing I'm doing is getting out there. I'm going to make Lovecraft Tijuana Bibles. And from there, it was like, actually, that's not a bad idea. And then having met Tim and Zoe at the last year's convention sort of thing, and then I was like, you know what, I'm going to do this. So came to them with ask for stories. The cinematographer that I work with and who co-owns Deadbolt Films with me is also a tattoo artist that's been wanting to do comics for yonks. Right. And so I approached him very, like, over a pint, was like, look, I want to do this comic. Don't judge. It's full of tentacles and some, you know, kinky situation. And he was like, yep, I'll do it. And then he had a blast doing it, which was amazing. This is Ben Hamill, fantastic artist, fantastic tattoo artist. Anyone's seen the art, it's brilliant. He had a blast doing the stories we wrote for it. And then obviously I got the stories from Tim and Zoe, and we threw them out there and see if anyone wanted to do the artwork. The artist that came back for them, absolutely amazing as well. It just all worked really nicely. And then when we put it on Kickstarter,
that blew me away. That really did.
Oh my God, the amount of love we got for that. It was, yeah, absolutely bonkers. Like, really, really insane amount. Which is great, because now we've been able to put, like, half of that we've actually put into the film company. Where we're now working on a, we're actually in the very early stages of trying to put together a pitch deck for a full feature cosmic horror.
Oh, brilliant. So one thing helps spark something else. Well, that's great, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's just the way that it's all coming about really nicely. Like you said, it's just flowing effortlessly, really.
And Eldritch Lust is basically a collection of, what would we call it, Lovecraftian erotica? Would that be?
It's cosmic horror smut.
that's what I would have called it. Yeah,
it's
tentacle filth.
Absolutely. It's an anthology. As mentioned, we've got Zoe Burgess Foreman's on it, Tim's on it. We've got the first one out, did amazingly. Now looking at doing the second one because it did so good. But yeah, like each of the stories in there are fantastic as well. I'm just amazed. We've really seemed to knock it out of the park, actually. There's a bit in there for everyone as well. When we set about doing it, Ben and I sat down and we were like, right, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it proper. We don't want it to be, you know, your quick... We don't want it to be like actual Tijuana Bible, just like hastily drawn, slapped together, sold for like pennies. But we wanted to make sure that what we were doing was going to be inclusive and be open for everyone. Yeah, just be really good quality comic in its own right. Like the artwork had to be impeccable. If we were going to sell this, we wanted something that was going to be, you know, perfect. I think we've achieved it. If I do say so, I mean, that sounds well smug.
No, I totally agree. Because from my perspective, I was incredibly blown away about it because you came to me asking if I knew any artists who might be interested. And while I was doing that, I was like, how are you doing for writers? I have some stories kicking around that I could make smuttier. And so I did it. And then it was literally a case of, oh, yeah, cool. Yeah, I'll take that. I'll see if I can find an artist for it. And then it was literally like a couple of days later and you presented me with this artist's work. And I was just like completely blown away. I was just like, blimey, they're going to be like drawing that filth that I sent them. That's brilliant.
It's the amount of interest from people actually wanting to get on board has just been insane. Like I put up a thing the other day and I was bombarded with, I've had like 20 odd submissions for the next one already. It has been people just coming like, we really want to get on board with this. I don't know if that's because they saw the numbers on Kickstarter.
there is that, absolutely.
I think people just really like drawing boobs and tentacles.
Well, I think, at the end of the day, and why not? You know, I think, I can only think of, there was a collection of Cthulhu sort of sex stories, wasn't there, in one paperback. Was that late 80s, perhaps? Or
I can't remember the name of it now, but I remember the cover. It had like a guy from the back, a flasher, and there was tentacles coming out. Right. And there was like a topless woman on the bed. I can't remember the name of it, but it was always one of them that I wanted, but I never managed to get hold of.
Yeah. Oh, we're going to have to hunt that down.
I think Bobby Deary wrote Sex and the Cthulhu Mythos, which was out a little while ago.
Yeah.
But it seems to be like a neglected area. So obviously, as you found out, there's a huge demand for it.
Yeah, completely.
Because we had Zoe on a couple of weeks back, and we were saying exactly the same thing, of that there is definitely an audience for this kind of thing out there. I mean, how hard have you found it to actually connect with that audience? Have you found it pretty easy or difficult to find these people?
To be honest, that most of them come to me and they've just seemed like the greatest people. I've really connected with some of these people in that audience now, and they're like, it's weird to have, I don't want to use the word fans, that people actually know your work as well and that side of things. Very strange. And actually connecting with them been kind of, at first it was hard because I was like, God, is anyone actually going to want this still? Like, but again, turns out they do. And we have people from all over the place. I'm trying to think where the furthest one. Definitely a few from Japan, which was probably the furthest from where we are at the moment. But Australia, all sorts, yeah.
And in terms of creative people, I've found, pretty much everything I've done and we've done together, that it seems to be a very supportive community, the Lovecraftian or weird fiction community. And people who get involved have a real interest in it rather than just thinking, oh, yeah, I can knock this out for and make a bit of money, perhaps. You know, there seems to be a genuine passion there.
Definitely. I think that was probably one of the nicest things about the Literary Festival last year, is like actually meeting other creators that work within that space. That was fantastic. You know, made some proper good friends there, like people that I will phone up and say, oh, I'm down in Brighton, do you want to come for a pint? And they'll just come out. Yeah, I wonder who that could be. But it's like, and it's lovely, it's really nice, and it's really good to have that sort of creative support as well. I mean, it's kind of nice coming from the online comic space as well, the indie comic space, is that is also a very, very supportive community. Like quite regularly you'll see people like just sharing everybody else's work and just bigging up everyone's work, and that's lovely as well. So there is definitely a really good creative community out there, and I think if you go find your tribe in that sort of space, you'll find people that are there to support that, those that you know will push you to do better things as well. Like, I never thought I'd ever have one comic out, and now I've got like half a dozen sort of thing. But yeah, no, it's incredible. And obviously it's good to be able to support other people as well. Like when you guys did your Kickstarter and get that out, like I was able to share that to people, and it was like, come on, get on this. This looks amazing. So it's all that side of things. I just think that's what it should be about.
Yeah, it does seem a very healthy scene at the moment. And I think as well, perhaps what helps that is, I mean, technology, in terms of it's very easy to publish and print stuff now.
Yeah.
And also things like Kickstarter. I mean, I've used Kickstarter for all the Innsmouth Gold anthologies and done well with it. And you couldn't have conceived of doing that sort of 10, 20 years ago. You know, you think back to Lovecraft, who struggled even to get sort of 200 books printed, you know, which is... Now it's a click of a button, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I kind of feel bad. It's like, oh God, I've got stuff out there, and you know, and he struggled.
I think it's easier with the communication as well, because you've got to think about it. I mean, just look at the amount of letters that man wrote and all the rest of it. But you got the physical thing that he had to write the letter, take it down the post office, and send it off, and wait for a reply. Whereas we're at the touch of a button, right? So we could communicate with people in three countries over, you know, that kind of thing. So I think finding, like Tom said, finding your tribe is easier for that respect, because you go on all these little groups and you find people. And you, I don't know how it happens. You just end up like, it's almost a weird osmosis. You end up talking to them, and the next thing you know, you're in a book with them, you know?
That's it. Completely. It just seems so crazy these days. It's fantastic.
So let's look at, let's talk about your films then as well. So you mentioned Deadbolt Films there, and I know you've got a number of short films out. Were you at the film festival in the States with one of them?
I think every one of our short films that we've done so far has premiered at the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival. So we've got a bit of but they've all been accepted, which has been absolutely fantastic. I mean, that was the first one. The first one we did was Nothing Hurt. And we weren't too sure. And that was a really strange thing. That was when I first got into screenwriting, and a friend of mine turned around and was like, oh, you should speak to our mate Gav, he's made a horror film in the past, and you should go pitch him some ideas. So I basically pitched him this idea about a World War II soldier getting in a confrontation with a Nazi, and then all goes very much Ambrose Bierce, what's that occurrence that our freak thought of me. That was the biggest. I love nice. That story. I love that.
It's an amazing story.
So good. Yeah. It all goes very much like that. Like he lives through, and then you find out he's actually, well, I don't want to give it away, but anyway, so we made that, which was an absolutely insane shoot, to be fair. We decided, we put a date for when we were going to film, and then it decided to be one of the worst snowstorms we've had around here in a while. So that was fun. Right. Pushing cars up hills, and someone burnt out of the motor, and it was chaotic. And then the next, so what happened as well is we only had one of the actors for one day, and that was the day when the snow was, and this was the guy that was playing the German. Yeah. So we were like, God damn it, this is going to be a nightmare for continuity. Because obviously we went back the next day, and there's no snow.
The snow's
it all melted. We were just like, oh my God, what's happened?
It's not even like the snow stayed there, and you could say, yeah, it's set in winter, so, you know.
Exactly. At first we were like, you know what? Film gods, they're praising us. This is a really, really good thing for us. It ups our, you know, the visual quality and that. But yeah, they actually worked out really nicely, because these scenes with him kind of bookend the film. So it gives this, like, the middle bit, actually this extra air of weirdness to it, because all of a sudden it is quite, quite different.
Right.
So, yeah. So yeah, that was the first one. Oh, it was a brilliant shoot as well. So we did that, and then we've done a couple of others. Did Beyond, which features a certain King in Yellow.
Yes, nice.
Well, it was kind of like the King in Yellow mixed up with From Beyond, and Beyond the Wall of Sleep. All three of them just mashed into one strange story. That we're thinking, what can we do for the second one? Because we got into the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival. And as mentioned, I love that sort of type of strange film. Not so obliquely like horror, but, you know. Anyway, so we did that. And that was great. That was fun, like designing the costume for King in Yellow and everything. And then that got in. And we were like, wow, okay. And then we did another one called Take Three, which literally we filmed in one night. Started, I think we started at about 4 in the afternoon, and didn't finish till probably 4 in the morning.
Oh wow!
And again, that was with one actor in just one location, and that was a long shoot. But that actually worked out amazing. That got in. So now we're trying to up our game a bit more. The last thing we did was actually, it wasn't Lovecraftian at all. It was a Star Wars horror.
Nice.
Fan film. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sanctuary Moon, was it?
Sanctuary Moon, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we haven't got something really, because we can't feel we can send that to the Lovecraft Film Festival, because it's completely, you know, not relevant. But that's actually going to be shown on the May the 4th be with you.
Nice.
At a sci-fi convention in Ireland, where they shot all the scenes of Luke on his little island with his weird horse and all that. It's in the same place where that was filmed, in The Last Jedi. Really? Yeah, so we're quite excited. We've been nominated for a couple of things on that. Sadly, writing was not one of them. but
it's a great looking film. I was going to ask you that as well. How do you have to get around the licensing thing? I mean, how does that work?
We don't talk about it.
Okay.
No, we didn't make any money. We didn't make any money from it. I mean, they're pretty. Yeah, Disney are pretty relaxed when it comes to fan films, I think, because they know.
Well, I was going to say, it's fan fiction.
Exactly. We're not making money from it. It's fan fiction. Everything we made went straight back into production, to be honest. All the costumes and that cost a fortune. I think we lost money on it. But we hope, like, the effort that we put into it kind of speaks for itself. It's had some good viewing numbers. I think it's currently at either 40 or 50,000 views on YouTube. And that is now inspired us to go back to the original cosmic horror element for our next our feature, hopefully.
Awesome.
That we can get made this year.
So what exactly does a screenwriter do, and how in my mind you're writing the script and that sort of thing, but I could be totally wrong, and how does that compare to writing for a comic or writing a short story or something like that?
So yeah, essentially the screenwriter is the script. It's the groundwork for everything that the film is based on. It's like the person that comes up with the blueprint for like housing, architecture, and all that, and then everybody else on the team works up from that. I mean, I'm quite lucky in the fact that, you know, we run this production company, and I'm kind of like part of the in-house crew on that now. So I also work quite closely with our director Gav and the producer John and Ben, who does cinematography. So it's more collaborative for me now, which is great. Because I've done a couple of feature scripts that I've optioned, sold off to other places, and it's completely out of my hands. Where now, because we're doing it in-house, I can also take on a more of a creative producer role as well, which is lovely, sort of helping. So, yeah, it's basically the screenwriter is the person that comes up with the idea, or at least builds the basis for which everything else is built on. How it differs to writing comics. So that was probably one of the hardest things to get my mindset around. When you're writing screenplay, you're often writing, obviously you're writing all the action that's happening on screen. So you move, like, you have to write like, oh, so-and-so, like Stormtrooper One looks over his shoulder and is, I don't know, staring at the Sarlacc about to eat him or something like that. Whereas on the comic side, you would just basically put, you wouldn't do the actual movements. You'd just put Stormtrooper looking over shoulder rather than look. It's more in the way that you word things, and you have to think of like in panels,
right?
And how the story moves on from panels. So it's like taking one picture from a scene or something like that, and then doing it in that way. So it's weird jumping back and forth from the two. You have to be quite conscious, like, oh God, I can't actually do like movement in a comic because it's just not going to move. Not yet anyway, not unless it's one of the old Marvel motion comics.
Yes, yes, I remember that.
Yeah, because this is something we talked about in the pub the other week, because like me going from a writer perspective, I'm so used to going, and then he walked pensively down the corridor. He looked to his left through the window. So I was still doing that.
Yeah.
And he came along with his scissors and cut it all out.
I felt so bad, but I was like, yeah, you can't show them walking. Well, you can show them walking, but you can't say they walked or...
Yeah.
Because it would just be like, how does one draw that? You have to give directions to the artist. But obviously, there's also that fine line of being able to give the artist enough to draw something and also have their own interpretation and open it up, which kind of, again, it ties in quite nicely with screenwriting, because that's kind of what you're doing for then the directors to come and go like, well, actually, I don't think this theme works in the way you've done it, like the way you've scripted it. It doesn't quite look that way in my head. I'm going to do it this way. And there's similar artists on the comic will do exactly the same sort of thing. So I think that's why certainly Ben and I work really well together in regards to Eldritch Bluff, purely because, you know, he's the cinematographer DOP on all our films. So he knows how I work on that, and then I know exactly how he's going to try and envision it as well. So it works out quite nicely.
And then presumably as well, you have the actor will put his or her own mark on the performance of the actual words, so there's another layer of creativity on
this. Absolutely, and I think it's the I actually love the collaboration on it. The initial writing of it can be a bit of a slog, but as soon as it gets into the collaborative bit and you pass it on to someone else and they have their input, and then you pass it on to another person and they have their input, and you see this beautiful thing come together at the end. And I'm not overly precious when it comes to like my scripts or anything like that. I don't say like, oh, you can't change this, you can't. I love it. I love it when someone reads something I've done and go like, you know what, Tom, that's a bit off. Let's do something a bit better in here. And working that way, I love it. It's just fantastic. So just being able to put the building blocks there and then building from that is amazing. But you'll see that, like, certainly in comics, you'll see that from every single aspect of it. I just sent out Eldritch Bluff to the letterer, who the whole job is just to letter it, make it look pretty. I just said to him, like, look, if something's not working when you come to lettering, just do what you think will make it look great. I have total trust in him. That's Ken Reynolds, fantastic guy as well. So, but yeah.
That's nice when you can do that in a creative project, isn't it? Just let that person do what they do and, you know, not have to micromanage.
Yeah,
it's brilliant. I love it. It's so good. But, I mean, you know, there's an element of, like, management there, but it's not... certainly when you work with people that you, like, implicitly trust as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you put together a good team, and it's always good to get together a team that you're all on the same page. Again, Eldritch Lust, it just worked amazingly.
Like, yeah, it's the same thing like when we do anthologies and things like that. Like, if I go, here's the theme, Rob, go off and write me 10,000 words about ghouls. I know I have full trust in Rob to go off and write me a story about ghouls. Yeah, you know, yeah. So I guess it's the same kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, massively so. I mean, I have a lot of respect for people that can write stories like that. I can't. I don't think I'm there. So I have a very certain way that I like writing, which is very much in a comic and screenwriting format. I've tried writing normal prose and all that, and I just can't. I can't do it. Like, so
I tried writing normal once as well, and it didn't work. So I'll stick with the weird.
Stick with weird. Yeah.
Say normal. I mean, yeah, no, it, yeah.
So, is there another consideration? I mean, something we've spoken about before, especially when it comes to film adaptations, and Lovecraft's a prime example. As a story writer, you can do anything.
Yeah.
I guess as a comic writer, you can do pretty much the same. As a filmmaker, you can't have 3,000 Imperial destroyers show up and there's a huge space battle. You know.
And I think that's where why cosmic horror is so hard to adapt to film.
Yes.
As well. Because you can't do that, and you're always going to be limited to budget and so much. And so in comics, obviously, just through decent art, you can get a grand scale of things. So like you said, like in writing, like novels and stuff like that, again, you can get away with murder, essentially, but you can't in film. And that's probably the biggest downfall. I mean, that's certainly like, We tried to pull off certain effects thinking, oh, this will work. And it just looks a bit like, you know, a bit dog toffee, to be fair. When it comes to the screen, it's like, oh, it's not quite there. And we've had to go back and rethink things. And yeah, it's all a bit. But no, completely. You can't quite get away. And yeah, and I guess that is probably one of the hardest things about certainly adapting Lovecraft to film. I mean, how many adaptations we've all seen that have just been ruined because they revealed the creature and it's just...
It's a bloke in a suit.
I don't want to say man in a suit because Alien is just a man in a suit. But, you know, it's...
It is a bloke, yeah. I mean, Alien was kind of a... It was exceptional the way they did it, wasn't it? The whole approach to it. But then, when you get...
Well, there was a lot of not showing, wasn't there? There was a lot of shadow shots.
Exactly. Yeah. Little glimpses and all that stuff. And that's why the impact lessens by the time you get to 2, 3 or whatever. They actually have to make the alien bigger, right? They have to have the big mother alien.
You're always amping up the odds, yeah.
And it's the law of diminishing returns kicks in then, doesn't it? It's, you know... That's the problem. That's why, like, Aliens went for, here's loads of aliens and a big one.
Yeah.
So when in the third one they tried to change it up and went for the more survival horror kind of thing with a little dog alien-y kind of thing, right? Which is a great idea. It just didn't have the impact because we'd already seen hundreds of the damn things trying to kill Michael Bane, right?
I will not have a bad word said about Alien 3. I love that film for what it is.
No, I love Alien 3. I thought it was great.
Yeah. I think it's very much, maligned. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
I don't think it deserves the hate that it gets. And certainly when you see what's come afterwards,
Exactly.
I like Alien 4. I like Alien Resurrection just for that. I had a very comic book weirdness to it. Like, they just went straight all out. It is just weird. It's an odd film.
I think the other aspect of cosmic horror that is difficult to get across, and again in the stories, Lovecraft in particular, you get the characters' internal dialogue, their internal state.
Yeah.
I suppose in film you can have that to an extent with how the actor is moving or their expressions, but is it difficult to get across that feeling of something's not quite right here and I'm feeling a bit uneasy and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I think that's one thing. Sound is brilliant in a film. You can get, obviously, the certain choice of music can convey that feeling and emotion to the viewer, and it's doubled up with like the perfect actor doing it. It can really, you don't need that internal narration. You can just feel the dread pouring from the screen. But again, that's incredibly rare. Like not many films I can think of. Well, I can think of a fair few, but not many do it right. Like always, yeah, misses something.
I mean, that was always a thing back in the day, wasn't it? Like the score was incredibly important before we could rely on special effects and things like that. Well, Alien is a prime example.
Yeah.
You had that spatial aspect to the soundtrack, which just conveyed emptiness and a sense of being alone and things like that.
I'm getting goosebumps from thinking about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you get that little trill, that little violin trill when something's not quite right. And you know instantly, it puts your hairs up, doesn't it? You know?
That, absolutely. I think that's probably the best way to convey it, obviously, in film, without having to go the whole internal dialogue and that.
Yeah.
That never really works.
No, I'm thinking of most Lovecraftian adaptations. I mean, things like Reanimator and that sort of stuff, they take a very particular approach, almost slapstick in some respects, and I love Reanimator and From Beyond and everything, but they don't really touch on that cosmic aspect so much, I don't think.
No, they really don't. I like them for what they are.
Oh, same. Yeah,
definitely. They're fun. They're very much of their time. You get what they're going for, but you don't get that cosmic sense from them at all. From Beyond was all right. It did a pretty good job at it. I think that's probably the best one.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's controversial or not, but that's probably the one I enjoyed the most.
Well, most boys who were teenagers at the time it came out, it's their favourite because of Barbara Crampton in that film. But I digress.
I can see you digressing from here. I think Dagon did a pretty good job. I mean, it's basically The Shadow over Innsmouth, a modern version. And it did, you had that element of the horrible thing at the end and a very downbeat ending, I suppose. But it's still pretty much a chase movie with monsters.
And I think what let that down was some of the CGI elements of at the end, like where she's got, yeah, again, no spoilers for no one that's watched, for people that haven't watched it, but yeah, I think the CGI let it down. But yeah, I think that's probably the closest they've done to an actual decent adaptation. But yeah, I'd still choose From Beyond over it.
I think one film that does spring to mind that got that kind of sense was one that it's debated whether it's cosmic horror or not, which would be Event Horizon.
Yeah.
I thought that got that nice feeling.
That did, yeah. Event Horizon, was a great film. They're doing a remake of that now, aren't they? Or turn it into a TV series or something along those lines.
They are, yes. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it's kind of a prequel to the Warhammer 40K universe, isn't it?
I love that theory. I love it.
It's been confirmed. Yeah, that theory has been confirmed.
Is that what they've actually said?
Yeah.
I love 40K. I play 40K. I paint a lot of miniatures and stuff like that. Very much Death Guard for anyone that cares. But yeah. I love that entire thing. That is like the prequel for it, like the whole Geller Fields, and that's what it is. It's actually going through the warp and the chaos demons, and just, yeah. Because that's what I love about the 40K. Sorry, sidetrack on. I love that about like the 40K is all the cosmic horror that lurks within that. I recently read, recently played Rogue Trader, and there was just one planet I think you go to. I can't remember now that game had like hundreds of hours in, and they're worshipping something and it never really says what it is, and it was just very, I was like, oh my god, this is probably one of the best Lovecraftian games I've ever played, without it actually being like Lovecraftian or anything like that. It was like, this is bonkers. Loved it. It was all the what's not said and about what's happening on certain planets, and yeah, love it.
Do you think that's partly it with Lovecraft? It's when people try and do a direct adaptation, there's always that little stumble. I think like the Colour Out of Space, the recent Colour Out of Space, for example, which had good points, but
yeah, Tommy Chong, we sort of ran away with that movie for me. He was a hero.
But sometimes it's those Lovecraftian films. I mean, even Alien itself or The Thing, they're not direct adaptations, but they seem to capture it much better.
Oh, absolutely. It does seem like it's not the films that are directly based on, but the ones that are inspired by, the ones that take the elements from. I wish I was more intelligent to tell you why that is the case, but it's odd. I'd never seen, I wanted to see Del Toro's take on Mountains of Madness. Yeah. That would have been brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not so sure now after seeing Cabinet of Curiosities. But
I'm so glad you mentioned it. Like, oh my God.
To be fair, he kind of curated the collection rather than
true,
himself.
But he signed it off.
Well, yeah. the buck stops
with him. Oh my God, that was talking about disappointing Lovecraft adaptation.
Well, you think he would have said about the Dreams in the Witch House one when he read that? No, that isn't actually
Dreams of the Witch House at all.
Have you even read it?
It's a fairy tale. It's like, what the hell? It's like, yeah, where's all the weird math? It's now just fairy tale. The Autopsy was a good one though, wasn't it?
That was good.
It was.
Can we all agree that was a good story, isn't it?
Yeah, that was
that's a Michael Shea, isn't it? It's a Michael Shea story. Yeah. Yeah,
that was good.
that was good. But yeah, it's odd. I don't think it, I mean, obviously, like The Lighthouse isn't overly, is it? I don't know if I'd consider it like cosmic horror.
I would. Yeah, I think I would. Yeah.
I don't think I'm forward on the fence on that one.
Yeah. It's good. It's a good movie, though. Yeah.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's one of its, top five. I think it's fantastic. Like, where was it going? But again, that's a fantastic, that sort of took elements from Lovecraftian and just did something amazing.
I think Benson and Moorhead as well, their movies, like Resolution and Endless and things like that.
Yeah.
I think they do the same thing. They've sort of gone, well, we like this Lovecraft. Absolutely. And they've kind of created their own mythos. Because all them films are linked in some little way, shape, or form. So they've created their own, like their own weird Lovecraft country thing going on with this cult, and really good.
It's brilliant.
I was going to say, it's quite Lovecraftian in itself when we think of the Lovecraftian circle and all the ways it branched off. You know, I don't have any problem with people making their own sort of mini mythos, really, out of stuff.
Oh no!
And again, I think that comes back to the whole collaborating with other creators and stuff like that. I think that's another thing that appeals to me about the whole mythos and everything, is that so many people have had input into it now. It's hard to tell really where Lovecraft himself did something or didn't. It's now like this, and it feels bigger than just one person.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, which is its big strength, I think. You know, there's never going to be another Tolkien. He's gone, and whatever is written after is never going to match that, is it? You know, such a gifted writer in that field. and left such a detailed world that who could live up to that anyway? Just getting all the lore right, you know. Well, rings of power.
Yeah. <You know? laughs> Yeah, well, I think it was one of our previous guests. I think it may have been Paul Fricker, summed it up best when he said that it was basically like Lovecraft had this sandbox, and he invited all his mates to come play in it. They didn't all have the same toys, but they all played in the same sandbox. You know, I think that's a great analogy.
That's perfect. That is brilliant. It is, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah, that's essentially it, isn't it? I mean, yeah, and I think it's just great to be able to play in that sandbox. As a creator myself, to be honest, I love it.
So if you had budget and the choice of whatever cast you wanted and all the rest, would there be a particular Lovecraft story you do as a film and also as a comic or a graphic novel as well? Is there one story you think you could really apply yourself to?
I did start writing a sci-fi version of the actual Call of Cthulhu. I'd love to do that. I think that would be really, really good to adapt. That was as a comic. As for a film, I mean, obviously, Mountains of Madness would be the dream one, to be honest, because that's just such a good story. And if you had, like, no budget, like, I mean, you had no limit to your budget. If you had no budget and just go outside and go to Birdwell,
a shug off made out of bubble wrap.
Well, I think that's how we're going to do the next film, to be honest.
A shug off made out of bubble
wrap? Yeah.
KY jelly and bubble wrap. It worked for Doctor Who in the 70s, didn't it?
Spray it fluorescent green, no one will know.
Yeah. There'll be no chase. I definitely, you know. If there was unlimited budget, then Mountains of Madness would be a fantastic one to do. Don't know who I'd cast in it, though.
Yeah, because the thing you have with Lovecraft is it's not character driven, is it really? So you don't know. So and so would make a great Superman or something like that. You don't have that central character.
No, I don't think I've ever actually read any Lovecraft and gone like, you know what, this person would be such a great character. Like,
this guy'd be a good Peabody or a good Gedney. Yeah, it's
just... like everyone thought Tom Cruise would make a great Reacher, you know.
Yeah. Well, that was one thing. It's kind of a joke. I will not watch films with Tom Cruise in. So when they announced that he was going to be in, I literally was crying. So thanks Prometheus for coming out and putting an end to that film.
To be honest, I thought Interview with the Vampire was okay. I enjoyed the series more, but him in that role as the Stat was okay.
Yeah.
I mean, mate, others disagree.
No, he was all right. I mean, he didn't make me want to rip my eyeballs out for a change in that one. So,
so I saw that pre-boycott. So that was before I realised, you know what, I saw that as a kid and I was like, okay, he's all right. He's all right in that. And I enjoyed him in Magnolia.
I'm just never going to forgive him for Eyes Wide Shut. That should have been in a tremendous movie, but no.
Yeah. I've never been able to watch it. Just something about that. I think, I can't be bothered.
I've never watched it purely for one reason.
Well, to be fair, if you want to experience it, but a Lovecraftian take on it, play the games Lust for Darkness and Lust from Beyond, the video games. Ah. Yeah. There you go. That's basically Eyes Wide Shut with tentacles. There you go.
Oh, nice. Oh, fantastic.
Have you ever thought about writing for video game songs? Is that an option or something you'd consider or ever looked at?
I would absolutely adore to write for video games. It is definitely something I'm mentioning. I'm a bit of a big gamer myself. I actually was kind of honored to be able to help a friend of mine, Martin Kupski, who did the Westmark Manor video game, Lovecraftian video game, and they're just doing a new one called Westmark Legacy. And he was asked me a couple of things, like we went back and he threw a load of ideas and we went at a bit back and forth. To the point where we're actually really good friends now. He's from Sweden, but we collaborated on a graphic novel called Grimland, which was probably cosmic horror adjacent sci-fi horror. But But yeah, no, video games are definitely something I'd like to pursue, but I'm also very much aware it's hard to get into. Certainly as a writer, you kind of need that bit of experience, and me playing around in Twine and all these other game writing programs. Yeah. That, my dream would be to do that, to have a cosmic horror game.
Because I mean, there's two things there, isn't there? One is the obviously the quality of graphics and everything else. Now they're virtually at film quality. Yeah. I think it won't be long before they're full film. But also, I mean, I grew up when, well, it was the same with comics, to be honest. And you're a bit old to be reading comics, and you're a bit old to be playing computer games. And now the computer game industry is bigger than Hollywood. I mean, it's huge.
Well, Hollywood's becoming the video game industry now with all the adaptations and stuff, which I think is great because I like the way it's gone with it becoming series rather than movies. Because I just finished watching the Fallout series and it was a tremendous bit of work. But if they'd have tried to truncate that down into a 90-minute or two-hour movie, it'd have been crap.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? God damn, I love that series. That was a damn good series. I mean, the games, again, the games themselves were an inspiration on Abyssal Albion back in the day. They try to sort of capture a similar sort of feel in that. Did you ever discover the Lovecraftian places within Fallout?
I've actually written an entire chapter on them for a book I'm writing. there's threads throughout three, four, and 76. There's a whole mythos, Ugqualtoth.
Yeah.
There's a whole sub mythos through it with the Dunwich Borers, the Dunwich Building, all this kind of stuff, and the interloper and all that. I've done a massive deep dive into it.
I've got to say, I'm actually quite excited for this book. Having heard about the project before, I was like, oh, I think I really need to read this.
It's getting there. Just a lot of research.
Oh my God, yeah. But it's not even the big games and that are getting adaptations. I mean, I showed you Dredge. Dredge is getting an adaptation. What a weird.
Yeah, I know.
What a weird, like, game to. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm kind of both excited and terrified by that because I loved the game. I thought it was great. It was one of my favorite games of last year.
Nice.
But I'm just like, why?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to complain.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. just Lovecraftian fishing simulator. Yeah. Let's make a film out of it. Bizarre. They'll be adapting Necronomicon Pinball next.
Oh, they do.
The old Sega Saturn game.
Yeah.
That Deaf, Dumb and Blind. It does seem that in any sort of form of popular culture, you don't have to dig down too far to find the tentacles, you know.
No.
Lovecraft's influence just seems to be prolific. It's across everything.
Absolutely. Even in Star Wars, there's like this locked away deity called Abeloth. She was described very Lovecraftian, dark side creature. There's a whole horror section to Star Wars that I loved. And once again, probably got me into into Lovecraft as well. Alan Moore wrote a whole bunch of Star Wars, like short comics. I think they were collected in Devil World. And each of them, there's one called, what's it called? Tiltony? Protoshape? And it's the weirdest thing. It's just the weirdest Star Wars story ever. It's like these creatures send Leia or something back in time, or I can't even, the concept was just mental. If you ever get a chance, or I don't know if you've read it or not, but it's totally worth checking out because it is such a weird concept, and I loved it. That was part of the Devil World collection that they did of them. But yeah, even like Star Wars, there's things called Force Demons that are essentially like that side of things, and you know, an entire other dimension called Other Space, where these creatures lived and would occasionally come into our reality and start messing up force users and pirates and stuff. Oh, I can talk about that sort of stuff. Yeah. So it's so true. Like, you don't have to dig deep into any sort of popular culture to find Lovecraft. I mean, Doctor Who, Star Wars, I'm sure there's probably plenty of stuff in Star Trek. You know, even
there's loads in Doctor Who. I mean, right back to the 60s. So, yeah.
That's it.
It's something we've said a lot, isn't it? That cosmic horror, you can apply at any time, any place, any genre. You can put it into... I mean, you could have a Mills and Boone romance with elements of cosmic horror in, potentially, right?
I think that's what we've done with Eldritch Lust, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, Benson and Moorhead did it with Spring, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Benson and Moorhead Spring. That is essentially a romantic drama with an eldritch abomination.
I mean, that's pretty much the whole premise behind you and Zoe's podcast, isn't it, Tim?
It is indeed. Yes, indeed. Yeah, I thought about that earlier when we were talking about the budgetary constraints, because we did we covered Legend of the Overfiend recently, and we were talking about that then. It was just like, there's no way in hell they could do that with a film.
No.
But, you know, you've got the big tentacles that are slow through the city and all that kind of stuff.
That sort of thing works so well in anime as well, because again, they can get away with it completely.
Do you think is that why that stuff was animated, or was it like, did they think we want to do an animation and then made the film, or did they think of the idea and then think the only way we can do that is animation? I wonder. Chicken and egg.
That's an interesting question. Yeah.
Yeah.
Zoe might know. Zoe probably.
I'll put that to her next time we record. Yeah.
Yeah. She'll be all over it.
Yeah.
Well, I saw the last one you did was Tammy and the T-Rex or something.
Oh yeah, that was the last one. Yeah.
That must have been quite an interesting one, actually.
It was funny. It was a ridiculous film.
So what are the next projects you've got lined up, Thomas? You mentioned the possibility of a full feature-length film there.
Yeah, so we're going to do the plan is at the moment is to try and get about midway through the actual script itself. We've got some concept art. We're putting together a pitch deck. We eyeballed a couple of people that we know now that might have a bit of clout to be actors, and that's a feature film that we're going to try and get out there. Won't reveal too much, but it's kind of, I think I actually gave Tim the elevator pitch in the pub the other week of The Color Out of Space meets Fight Club.
Interesting.
But it's going to be, obviously low budget, because we don't have the budget, but that's the plan. I don't want to give too much away on it, but so there's that. And Eldritch Lust 2. We've got the Kickstarter for Eldritch Lust 2. The Kickstarter is not out, but the pre-sign up link is. We've had about, I think, must be nearly pushing 650 people sign up for that one now. So that will be the next project. We're just doing all the submissions at the moment. Then I think next week, Ben and I are going to go through everything, choose the stories, and that's going to be fun. And then after that, the plan is then to do another issue of Abyssal Albion, because it's been a little while since I did the last one because I've had so many other projects coming up. So to try and get that out of the way, and then we've got another comic coming out that Ben and I are doing. We've done some, once again, we've got an idea, started like the first five pages. We've got some concept art that's going to be quite interesting. Not cosmic horror, but still adjacent, I should say, and kind of adjacent to Eldritch Lust, but not as lusty.
Eldritch Crush.
Yeah.
Eldritch Petting.
Yeah, Eldritch Petting.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, you got me thinking now, because I remember them signs in swimming baths when you were a kid. Yeah. No, the no petting.
No petting.
Tentacles, there we go.
I never wanted to take my dog in there anyway, so I don't know.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, that's the project we got coming up at the moment. So,
And we're going to see you at ILF again this year.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, and have another existential crisis on stage. Which was my favourite part. Some chap came up to me and said, I've never seen a man have an existential crisis on a battle before. Yep, that was me.
That's brilliant.
That's just me in general, though.
Well, you seem to be doing all right on it, so, you know.
I'm surviving. As long as people don't ask me to talk too much. I'm better with my thoughts on paper.
I know exactly what you mean. I always feel more confident writing than speaking.
Absolutely. Yes, I'm really looking forward to that, and I'm really looking forward to the after party as well.
Yes, we went clubbing last time, didn't we?
Oh, last time was amazing. That was one of the most memorable nights. Just going up to what can only be described as, what was it, like a normal club?
Oh, very normal. It was where all the young kiddies from Bedford were. And they parted like the Red Sea.
The oldest in there, wiggling tentacles.
Yeah, they parted like the Red Sea, and I come stumbling through the door.
Yeah.
I want a pint. What's this?
They're still talking about it in Bedford to this day. So,
God.
Who are all these weird people in tentacle T-shirts?
So, yeah, going to be there, and also going to be at Fort Bubble up in Yorkshire Way.
Ah, right.
At the end of the year as well. So that should be pretty good. That's like first proper big indie Comic-Con that I would be showing at, actually.
Awesome.
Oh, last year was the first convention, like festival that I've ever been at. Not been at, but as a, you know, somebody displaying stuff. So that was a great experience. I couldn't have asked for better.
Mm.
You know, surrounded by my people. I was like, this is great. So, yeah, definitely.
Cool. Yeah, well, it's nice when that happens, isn't it? It is nice. Because we tend to, I mean, especially as writers, you tend to be quite isolated in your work, you know.
Yeah.
Potentially, so yeah, that's always nice.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it? Like, because I'd gone down the night before, and I was in the pub on the Friday night before the festival, and a couple of people I'd never met before, one of which was from Belgium and another one was from the US, came in the pub and to meet up, and it was just that lovely thing of like you get round any awkwardness just by going, so Haunter of the Dark, thoughts. You know what I mean? It's a proper icebreaker. And to have people know what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
And have an opinion on it is brilliant.
No, it's fantastic.
That is nice. Oh, one last question, because I hear Mr. Sargent is just pulling up in the bus outside, so we're going to have to be leaving in a moment. I notice on the credits and IMDb in particular, there's mention of a Mr. Paul Whitehouse, and on IMDb that is the Mr. Paul Whitehouse. Is it really the Paul Whitehouse?
No,
or is it another?
It's not another sadly. No, he is not our king in yellow. No, it's our mate who always gets asked this.
He must do. So, yeah, must.
I think we could just keep on we could just lie. He's never gonna know. We'll be like, yeah, Paul Whitehouse.
Well, you can't see his face in the film, right? He's got the mask on and everything.
Exactly. So it's like, completely. So, but no, sorry to disappoint on that one. It's not, no.
Oh, I was thinking like a sort of cosmic fast show sort of mashup.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Is that Scorchio? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Do my tentacles look big in this?
Brilliant. Well, thanks for coming in, Tom. It's been lovely chatting to you.
It's been brilliant being here. I've survived the night, which is good.
Well, you've got that to come, because we all go and leave you now.
We're leaving you.
Yeah.
Oh. Already hear them at the door.
But as you know, as we always say, particularly thinking of Eldritch Lust, what happens in Innsmouth stays in Innsmouth. So it's very discreet. Might give you some nightmare fuel for your next Eldritch Lost project.
As long as it doesn't go some of the stories I've read that have been submitted goes, I'll be happy.
All right, nice one. Thanks very much, Summers.
Thank you very much.
So there we go. Thanks for joining us today, folks. As we say, it's time now to knit back down and get on the bus out of town, because no one wants to be hanging around in Innsmouth after dark, unless, of course, it's Innsmouth after dark in Bedford after the splendid Innsmouth Literary Festival.
Smoothly done.
Yeah, I like that. Speaking of which, if you're a patron of the show and a supporter, you get free entry to the Innsmouth Literary Festival and After Dark, as well as some other benefits. You get access to bonus content for Innsmouth Book Club and Strange Shadows, our Clark Ashton Smith podcast. You get quarterly copies of Innsmouth News, and at the higher tiers, you get the opportunity to come and have a chat on the show as well. So check out our Patreon page for details of that. We've also had some people getting in touch on Discord. I have to say, Discord, I think it's somewhere we don't frequent too much, but I should be getting on it a lot more.
Yeah, I'm the same. I get confused by it. To be fair, I get confused by a calculator. But Discord, yeah, I find it quite daunting. It's all the tabs and things, and I kind of look at it and my brain melts, you know. But
I'm getting to grips with it. So apologies if I haven't answered any messages sooner. But there's been a nice chat going on there, particularly with Dom Dom Bear and Altar82. And there's been some suggestions. One was for a list of books and films that we've covered in the past. Ah. Could we put a list together? Which is a great idea. So we're going to be working on that. That'll take a little bit of work to get together, but we'll put that up as soon as it's ready. Another one was a suggestion to cover the works of Junji Ito, which I know we've spoken about
before. Yeah.
That's definitely on the list. And there was also a suggestion from Dom Dom Bear of covering children's Lovecraft stories. So things like Frozen Kingdom and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And the very hungry Cthulhu pillar. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So maybe. I've seen Frozen Kingdom and I wasn't overly impressed. But then I guess it's aimed at kids. So I was like, we'll think about it.
We could also look at like things like the real Ghostbusters episode. Oh, yeah. You know, the call of Cthulhu and things like that. That's not a bad idea.
And another excellent idea from Dom Dom Bear said, it'd be interesting if you talk about your own writing and how you write stories, that sort of thing. And funnily enough, quite by coincidence or synchronicity, that's something we're going to be doing next time.
Indeed, yeah. Next time we're going to be joined by Gavin Chappell and Alexandra Beaumont, and we're going to be doing exactly that. We're going to be talking about our own work, our processes in writing, all that kind of good stuff.
So yeah, that's going to be an interesting chat. They're both excellent writers.
Yeah.
So that's it for today. Thanks again for joining us. As always, do keep your comments, suggestions, and everything else coming in. You can comment on our Patreon page, our Facebook, our YouTube. You can send us an email at InnsmouthBookClub@outlook.com. Or if you have a question for Dagon, then you can aim that at DagonSack@outlook.com. We will be getting back to answering some of those in the next sort of few episodes. We'll return to DagonSack.
Yeah, it's currently festering in the back room of the bookshop. So it needs emptying pretty soon. Yeah.
Festering, that's a good word, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Yes. On that rather unpleasant note, thanks again for joining us today. It's goodbye from me, Rob Poyton.
And it's goodbye from me, Tim Mendes.